Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Well, friends, this is the first episode in a while where I'm not talking about esoteric Christianity directly. It does come up on this episode with TK Coleman, but I just want to say that I think that when we talk about spiritual pursuits a lot, we can get so, I don't know, kind of high-minded about it that we forget that all the temptations, but also the goals and the excitements and enthusiasms of what people call real life are always present with us as well. You know, a career, a family, creative endeavors, developing your body at the gym, all that kind of stuff, the stuff we shape our days around, and that to some extent we have to shape our days around because of the structures we live in, all that stuff. People call that real life. And, you know, I think that split between what we're seeking or what we're interested in or what we're deepening spiritually and real life can seem pretty profound. And also not just a split, but they can seem in opposition with each other. They can seem completely disjointed because the everyday life stuff has such an anxious opacity to it that doesn't allow you to see that you have a spiritual life. And also, that means that it might be very far removed from the work of meditating or contemplation or developing your inner life. So, you know, when you're deeply connected to the material world, you can be in a sort of sleep. But it's important to remember that the material world is spiritual too. And so are the pursuits that I mentioned. The Irish mystic philosopher John Moriarty, who I've talked about on the show, once said that matter is mind in hibernation. So matter itself is an aspect of mind that is just kind of sleeping, or just dormant, or waiting to be illuminated by the insights that are going on in your inner world. So how do you get it all lined up? Is it possible? What happens when you try to get your spiritual life and your material life, your inner life and your outer goals lined up? And what happens when you do that and things that you care about or you thought you cared about in the material world start to fall away? And you look at what's left and you're like, oof, I don't have as much stuff. I don't have as many goals as I thought I wanted. This all reminds me of the minimalist movement, which is about getting rid of the clutter and living a life where what's there resonates, glows even with meaning for you. So I asked TK Coleman on the show to talk about it with me. I know TK best as one of the minimalists, with Joshua Fields Milburn, who is in episode 216, and Ryan Nicodemus. They have a great podcast, and they offer tons and tons of resources to people who want to cut out from their lives what is not really integral to being. TK and I talk about how to have a spiritual anchor in the sway of materiality, the material world's goals, but also its attendant political conversations and temptations and misdirections. I could tell you a bit more about all of this, but I think there's so much in this episode. I don't think I need to. It was such a fun conversation too. So I'm very excited to share this episode on creating a spiritual anchor, or what a spiritual anchor for us looks like as we're trying to progress in our everyday lives with TK Coleman. Please do support the show on patreon.com/ConnorHabib. I don't have any sponsors like the minimalists. I think the advertisements suck. They're just completely out of alignment with the show. So this is as close to an advertisement as I'll give. Support the show because you like the show. And also, you know, when you give into something like this, it creates a connection that I think is worthwhile. So patreon.com/ Connor Habib. Thanks a lot. Here's my conversation with TK Coleman. Hi, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Hello, TK Coleman. It's great to meet you and talk with you.
Hey, man, it's great to meet you, too. And like I was telling you off the air, but I think your viewers deserve to hear it. I think you're a very interesting thinker, and you are one of the people out there who is not only genuinely curious, but you're allowing your conversations to be dictated by those same curiosities. I feel like the easiest thing to do now is to be a reactionary philosopher who is only asking questions that are relevant to trending debates. And I love how you're free to delve into those things, but you're not governed by them. So it's an honor to be able to chat with you, man.
See, this is honestly, it's why I knew I would have a good conversation with you. And as soon as, you know, because I was scheduled to have a conversation with you all the minimalists, and things just didn't go that way. And so when I talked to Joshua, he's like, you got to talk with TK. And the more I just sort of looked into you on my own or on your own and everything you were doing and just listening to what you had to say, I knew because, and this is where I want to start with you, you know, morality and what's needed right now in the world is not just about It's not an ethical struggle of resistance. It's about creating good. And I think that what I see you doing, and maybe it would be the way that if someone asked me what you're up to, I would say this is someone who's interested in creating good, which is a very different task. I'm not saying that there's no resistance piece. There's no maneuvering against what's not good in the world, but you're actually working to open up something new, to create something new that is goodness for people. And so I want to start there with those two currents. And most people right now, the conversation seems to be in that resistance struggle, which is always characterized by struggle, right? But you're doing something quite different, I think.
That's true. I think about... Can I quote a Bible verse? A lot of people, I feel like if I quoted Pinocchio or a Little Red Riding Hood or Confucius or Buddha, I can get away with it. But man, you're treading on dangerous ground whenever you whip out the Bible. It's hard not to look like a fundamentalist, right?
Don't worry about it. If they think about you for bringing up the Bible, they're already thinking about me. So don't worry about it. Just go for it.
There are two Bible verses that I really like that speak to this. One of them says, all things are permissible, but not all things are profitable. So some things are not a matter of getting into debates with one another about which is the one right way to do things. Sometimes it's just about stepping back and identifying a path forward that is going to be most conducive to your priorities and your principles. Mm-hmm. The second verse is, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Mm-hmm. I have always believed that the best way to promote goodness is by actually focusing on goodness and doing the best that you can to bring that forth in a way that is unique to the kind of contribution you're optimized to make. However, there are a lot of economic incentives for people to make us think otherwise. Mm-hmm. We are highly incentivized to believe that our feelings and our thoughts are unimportant unless they are framed in reaction to something that everyone else is angry about. The algorithm is very good at making you feel like a total nobody if you're not talking about the latest political scandal, the latest celebrity scandal. And so we learn how to play the game if we want to be relevant, if we want our anger to be relevant, if we want our mm-hmm. convictions to be relevant. And a message like mine, where you focus on the good, can easily sound like some sort of naive philosophy that says, close your eyes and pretend like big issues don't exist. Close your eyes and pretend as if systemic and structural issues are not real, as if evil is not real. And it's actually quite the opposite. It's saying when you focus on what's in your locus of control, you're not copping out. You're actually opting in. You're choosing to have some agency. You're choosing to have a say about the direction in which this world moves. You're choosing to be someone who asserts their right and responsibility to influence. And so I'm not mad at anybody who spends hours a day watching the news and getting angry and outraged at everything that's going on in the world. But for me, that's never really been a path that has inspired me to behave constructively. And so for me, morality isn't about the mood that I'm in. It's not about how I feel. It's about what I do with those feelings, what I do with those ideas. And so when I focus my attention in a life-giving manner on what's possible in the world, what we can create, what we can innovate, that actually motivates me to get out there and do things that makes me healthier and that makes other people's lives better. So it's not a moralist position. It's not a snobbishly held elitist position. But for me, it's just a way that has worked very well at getting me to get off my butt, get out of a self-righteous mindset, and engage reality in a way that creates whatever changes are possible for me to make. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's interesting because it is at once more demanding, but more filled with, I think, love and joy to take that move. Because if I'm reminded by myself or by my spiritual connections, whatever, that I'm actually helping direct the thing, that I have a place and we have a place in directive, not just resisting and also not just, you know, certainly not just spectating, but that it is in some way up to me, then that's a lot. Yeah. And in fact, you know, it's something I've been dealing with personally a lot lately is the kind of assessing my life and where it's at now, everything that's got me to this point, and also understanding that I need to make room for what's coming in and where I need to go. Mm. And that's demanding, but because it's minimalism of the spirit in a way where I'm just removing the things that are fettering the way for what needs to come in and through. And especially for someone who has had, you know, moderate level of success, a success that I would not have anticipated or dreamed of when I was like, you know, in my 20s, I'd be like, so thankful that I'm at one. But now it's like, yeah, but let that go. Actually, if it comes in that you need to move to Bulgaria and, you know, be a shepherd, like go do that, you know, go do whatever it is that needs to come in.
Yeah.
But that letting go and making room for what actually needs to happen is the process of that demanding directive that also feels loving and like love at the same time, you know?
That's kind of makes me think of how in spiritual philosophy, there's the dance between the aesthetic and the ascetic dimension. Mm. The aesthetic dimension is, it involves focusing on beauty and bringing forth that which is beautiful. And so, you know, whether it's gazing at icons or, you know, looking at a sunset admirably or listening to music and experiencing a sense of connection through all of these beautiful experiences, you got to have an aesthetic dimension because that's what keeps you inspired, you know? But then there's also the ascetic dimension, which is not as fun. And that's kind of like the path of purification. What are those things that by letting go of, I can become better? And it's all things are permissible, but not all things are profitable. So I'm not only considering letting go of things because I have to, but beyond what is mandatory, beyond what other people demand of me, how can I make room for a higher kind of abundance, if you will, by challenging myself to let go of things that I would perfectly be within my right to hold on to. How can I create space for new kinds of abundance in that way? And that's kind of the ascetic dimension. And I think that's not as popular because it typically isn't as fun to focus on things like purification, right? But it's also, it also doesn't really get you, it doesn't really get you social rewards in quite the same way. You can be a star if you're really good at the aesthetic dimension, right? But the aesthetic dimension is antithetical with being a star. Mm. And that's incredibly difficult because what good is it to strive towards sainthood if no one sees you as a saint? What good is it to be good if you don't get the credit for being good? But that's often the cost that's involved, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, two things on that. One, I'm thinking of, it's interesting you use the word purification because it's actually the word that's been sort of weaving its way through my blood lately. Mm. Like I want people to know when I say that word, though, that I don't mean that I have any condemnation of anyone else's behavior or even my own, that I'm just being asked to get rid of certain things. I'm just being asked to make room by removing certain things, but not others. And I can tell what those are, you know, in my life. I realize I'm being a little vague, but, you know, I think you get the gist. But I'm thinking about that dance between the aesthetic and the ascetic that you're bringing up. There's, you know, when we look at the sun and it's giving off all that light and it's giving us all that warmth every single day, and it's beautiful, so beautiful that you can't even look at it. You know, you look at it and you turn away like a lover who's blushing when someone checks them out. You know, it's like you can't keep your eyes on it. And there's this thing that Rudolf Steiner, who comes up on the show a lot, and I can talk about him more if you want, but you know, he says the sun is a negative space, and it is through that virtue by which it shines. That nothingness is actually that kind of emptiness, that true spiritual receptiveness is what allows it to ray out with its aesthetic beauty, is the aesthetic negative space. And so they really fulfill each other, you know?
Hmm. Yeah. So a couple of things there. One, there's a kind of concrete, pragmatic playing out of this very theme. So if you take competitive sports, for instance, I remember several years ago reading an article where Shaquille O'Neal said that one day he walks into the gym and Kobe Bryant had already been there for hours. He doesn't even have a ball in his hand, but he's running around the court, going through various motions and offensive sets. And Shaq asked him, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Well, most of the time on a basketball court, you're spending your time playing without the ball. And I don't want to be the kind of player who only knows what to do when I've got the ball in my hands." And there was a recent documentary about the U.S. Dream Team where LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and some of the other NBA stars at that time, when they played in the Olympics with Kobe, they said they would go out clubbing and it would be, you know, 3-4 in the morning. They'd come back and they're getting ready to go to bed, and they see that Kobe has already finished his first workout. Mm. Now, if you try to take that level of dedication, one more citation is there's a Katy Couric interview with the rapper Lil Wayne, who was explaining to her that he doesn't really go to clubs. And she says, "Well, why don't you go to the club?" And he says, "Because I want to be the guy that they listen to when they go to the club. And so I got to make a choice. Mm-hmm. You know, I either go to the club or I get to be the guy that the people at the club listen to." Mm. Now, if you take that kind of dedication, that kind of sacrifice, and you turned it into a prescription, and you went to a high school or something, and you said, "All right, everybody, this is what you got to do to be successful," you would create a mental health pandemic, right? Because people would be following this like a rule. They would feel guilty when they didn't live up to it. They wouldn't feel like they are enough. And so How can both of those things be true? How can this be a form of unhealthy advice to give to other people? And yet at the same time, the very key to greatness in a certain sense. There are some truths that only seem to work when you discover them or discern them from the inside out, rather than when you take them on from someone else as a prescription. Mm-hmm. And what I hear from you with your path of purification is that it's not this guilt-laden, religiously dutiful process where you're doing it because you have to do it, because someone told you to do it, but it's welling up from some place within you. I imagine the same inner impulse that compelled Kobe Bryant to say, I'm going to show up to the gym early. That mm-hmm. compels Lil Wayne to say, instead of going to the club, I'm going to go to the studio. There's something within you that you have to do, but you don't have to do it. You don't have to do it because it's not a moral rule, but you have to do it because this innate impulse towards evolutionary expansion is compelling you to do it. Your nature demands it of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe the way I would say it is that it's, you know, it's an affirmation of God. It's an affirmation of spirit in my life, right? Like, you know, beyond me. If I can't always sense it that way, but there are times when I can, and so, and I'm willing to say yes, you know, and I'm saying that now. Call me again in a week and I'll be like, I thought I was willing to say yes, but you know, then this showed up. No, but I like this thing that you're talking about where the content of the way you do it is not something you can advise to others. Cause people ask me all the time, they're like, what book should I read? What meditation thing should I do? What should I? And I'm always like, we can have a conversation and I can figure that out, but I can't just blindly assign you a prescription for it because it's not going to work. On an individual way, if you and I meet, we can talk about that. And maybe I could even talk about it in a small group of people. But as soon as it starts getting large, it's difficult. It's like, you know, for instance, you know, if you have someone who's like, you know, some millionaire and someone says, what did you do to become a millionaire? They always say stuff like, well, I wake up every morning at 5 and I go swimming in the sea. And then someone hears that and they're like, well, shit, let's give that guy a book deal called The Sea Swimming Secrets of Millionaires or whatever
it is. That's right. Yeah.
But the truth is, like, the thing that is valuable there is that he's created a rhythmic process in his life that shores him up, that gives him strength. And the thing that he's chosen to place in that rhythmic gesture, that pulse, that heartbeat is his to choose, you know, or hers to choose, or theirs to choose. But it's not the content of the choice that is, you know, that you can replicate. And you can't even, not everybody even needs the same kinds of rhythms. So it's really, on the one hand, it just could be the best advice you could give could be the worst advice in the world to people, you know?
Yeah, that's right. You know, in the spirit of advice, one piece of advice I give to people is respectfully listen to the advice, but pay closer attention, not to what people advise, but to what they admire. Because when you pay attention to the visceral response people have to what they admire, you're getting closer to the essence of what it is that truly makes for greatness, right? So that sea swimming technique, that would be the advice, right? We say, hey, this guy got up at 5 and you do this and so on. But what makes us respect him isn't that he read a book that said, this is what you should do, and you did it. What makes us respect him is that he made that up, that he somehow invented this narrative that if he did that, he would be successful. Or he listened to something in his soul that says, move in this direction. This is the way that is open for you. Go in that direction. Mm-hmm. And that's the part, right? That's the part that makes us admire people. And it's not the boiled down, distilled prescription that we extract from their lives. And so success stories are tremendously valuable, but it's kind of like the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. And you can read a success story and understand everything that's contained in the letter, and you follow it like a law, and you become a success legalist. But if you can capture the spirit of it, right, that spirit of greatness manifests in different lives in different ways. And by looking at different stories, you learn important underlying first principles about being willing to go against the grain, knowing when to follow your intuition, all of those types of things. So, yeah, I'm with you, man.
We can't actually even push culture, society forward by all doing the sea swimming thing. You know, like we can't, maybe there's a baseline thing of like, we eat healthy and we try not to buy shit that has no meaning for us, and we whatever. I mean, even that I think is, you know, can be excessive and ridiculous, as you guys talk about, you and the other minimalists talk about all the time on the show. But it's like, what is my way of bringing forward out of me what can help, what can offer, and what can be myself, you know, as I'm here. And that you can't really do that if we all take the same advice. That was that person's task, you know, that was that person's support, you know, support water, ocean, sea, you know?
Yeah.
So it is actually given to us to do something different. And that is ours, you know?
Yeah. And you know, when you actually look at the details of success stories, or maybe a better way is biographies, right? Because that's part of the problem. A success story is only that aspect of a person's biography that kind of zooms in on this tiny little detail, mainly those that are relevant to motivational speech or something like that. but when you look at biographies, you find that many of these people that go on to be great achievers or disruptors or influencers in the timeless sense of the word, they also do things that are so outlandish and so peculiar to them that it would be almost reckless to advise anyone to do it, right? I think about, I interviewed David Seltzer, who was the screenwriter for the horror film classic, The Omen. And he talked about how he got his start as a screenwriter. He wasn't a screenwriter. There was someone who had a crisis that he knew, who they lost a writer and they needed someone to write a script. And he said, oh, totally lying. Yeah, I do that. And they says, do you really? He says, yeah. And the guy says, hey, look, I'm really desperate for a writer. Don't BS me. If you're lying to me, just tell me. He goes, no, totally telling you the truth. Completely lying through his teeth. And he just makes up his mind. I am going to get this gig and make myself qualified for it. Mm-hmm. Now, can I encourage you to do that responsibly? Hell no, man. You've got to listen to that story. And if there's something in there for you, you'll know. You'll know exactly what it is. I don't have to spell it out for you. But the last thing I'm going to do is put myself in a position to let you say, well, TK told me I ought to lie to get the job. In fact, that's another aspect why you've got to look beyond people's advice and pay attention to what they admire, because people's advice also factors in the degree to which they do or don't want to be held liable, right? I can't give you that story as advice because I don't want your parents calling me, telling me I ruined your teenager's life, right? And so it's kind of nuanced in that way. I also think about a friend, Paige Kennedy, who's an actor today. And the way he got his start is he moved out to LA. He went with the friend who had an audition for a pilot, and he's just like going with the friend. And so as they go to sign in, they've got to put their name and their agency and all of that. And he's just there to be observing. And he decides, I'm going to sign in by writing my name and I'm just going to put an agency's name. He didn't know enough to tell a good lie, so he just made up a name. And his friend is like, man, you can't do that. Like, you'll get blacklisted in this town. Like, that's a huge no-no. Like, you just, any actor with a half decent amount of respect knows that you don't do that. Respect the freaking craft. Well, he does it. And he goes in for the audition and they look at his information and they look at him And they immediately know that he's lying and they call him on it. And he's like, oh man, I'm in trouble. And they say, well, you better not waste our time. If you're going to lie to get into an audition, you better be really good. Let's see what you got. And he lands the role in the pilot. Is that a success secret? All of the stories have these elements where people just do crazy things, where they see a window opening, they see a door cracked open, and something in them says, well, this is for me. And I'm not saying that what they did was the right way. I'm saying that finding your way involves a quality of thinking that simply cannot be apprehended by looking in a way that tries to make formulas out of other people's lives.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, I've never said this on the show before. Well, the first part I've said many times, but like, so I was a sex worker for 10 years and that was what I talked about everywhere. Like I got, you know, asked to write articles on pornography. I talked to lawmakers about how to treat sex workers better. And, you know, I did trade organization organizing for adult performers. I mean, I was like doing all this stuff and my world was that. My world was doing sex work and trying to, you know, stand up for the rights of sex workers. And so this is the part that I've never said online before or anywhere before, is that someone heard me on a podcast and was a guy who was a border control. He was an ICE agent, essentially. And he heard me talking about doing sex work and how I kind of wanted to do it for most of my life. And he quit his job. He was like, I can't do this anymore. I've never wanted to do this. I've never believed in it. And I've never been. I was that the reason I don't talk about it because it's boasting, but now it's so many years old, I feel okay saying it. And I'm sure there are a lot of other factors in his life that led him to that. But the point being that that's someone who looked at, he didn't become a sex worker, but he left the evil that he was standing in because he heard about someone who had liberated themselves from a certain kind of constraint that had tangled up a lot of other people. And that's what he drew from. So that's kind of what I'm hearing your talk about with all this, like, you know, look at what the person admires or look at what their spirit is reaching for. And you can pull from that. And that can bring all kinds of surprising directions for you in your life.
That's right, man. That's right.
You brought up spiritual philosophy before and something that's been sort of, it's been a bee in my bonnet for a while. You said you read a philosophy book that kind of shook things up for you, but you don't say what philosophy book that was in your bio. Like you have this thing about going to college and discovering this like book that your brother gave you. Is this ringing a bell for you?
What's the bio you're reading? I'm
sure. On Revolution of One. Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't have to include this, but it was
It's okay. Like
it was
I'm
like,
trying to remember.
It was like you said, you know, it was like your spiritual background with, you know, being a pastor's kid and all the things that you were allowed to do and not allowed to do. And then it's your brother gave you a philosophy book. I think it said, and it kind of shook things up. And I want to know what that book is, but maybe it was not as important as I thought it was. That was landmark.
Okay. Yeah. I just had to remember what you were talking about. Yeah. Okay. So for sure. I'll tell you that. So, my brother at this time was in Bible college and I think he was taking like an apologetics course or maybe a theology course that had an apologetics section or something along those lines. And I think I am like in my second year or like getting ready to go into my second year. I don't remember, but I remember that I was at home and I was visiting home in Chicago, even though I attended college in Michigan. And I would always go in my brother's room looking for good books because he always had a good book collection. I'd always find some gems there. And he had this article on his desk that was titled The Logic of Sesame Street And the name of the publication was Just Thinking. And the article was about, you know, like, you know, there was some song on Sesame Street where they were like up, down, opposites, in, out, opposites. And he uses this as kind of like a foundation for talking about the laws of logic, the law of identity, the law of non-contradiction, exclusive middle, and so on. And that was the first time I heard things framed in that way. And I thought that was really interesting. I was like, oh, this is really fascinating. And then there's another article. It's called The Complexity of Contextual Communication. I don't remember who wrote The Logic of Sesame Street, but it was Ravi Zacharias who wrote Complexity of Contextual Communication. Ravi Zacharias was probably one of the more popular Christian apologists. I want to say he passed away maybe about a year ago, and there's a big scandal surrounding his name. Some people, you know, may not mention his name. For me, I am of the camp that says never lie to yourself or to anyone about the positive contributions that any human being has made in your life. And so if someone says something to me that makes me think or changes my life path for the good, and then 10 years later, they get caught up in a scandal and their name is just has crap all over it, I'm not going to lie and pretend like that person didn't say anything to help me out. I'm not going to lie and pretend like they didn't do any good. So anyway, he had a stack of these articles, and I just like went through them, inhaling them. I'm like, man, this is so good. I don't even know what this is called, but this is so good. It was the first time I had seen the Christian faith of my upbringing approached, engaged, investigated in a way that was characterized by this, by the tools of Western analytic philosophy. And I was like, man, whatever this is, I got to have more of it. And I was at a stage in my life at that time where I had already went through my first year of college and growing up in an environment where I'm a pastor's son, very religiously conservative, not politically conservative, but very religiously conservative background. And I go to college and I'm seeing every kind of lifestyle imaginable, things that I had been sheltered from when I was a kid. And not only that, I'm meeting people that are Muslim, people that are atheists, people that don't even really think about religion, people for whom the question of God's existence is not as life-defining as it was for me. Mm-hmm. And they're funny people. Some of them are wise people. Some of them are just really good human beings to hang out with. And that kind of sent me for a spin, because how I had been conditioned to think about non-believers at that time, it lacked a lot of nuance. And I don't blame that on anyone, because we don't always inherit our beliefs explicitly. Sometimes it's tacit. We just assimilate it based on how we observe other people, you know, reacting to outsiders and so on. But I was having my own crisis of faith, if you will. And so when I saw this, I was excited, not because I said, okay, I believe, but because for the first time, I felt like, oh, there is a home. There is a space that I can go into where asking these kinds of questions are embraced. And when I went back to school, I went straight to the philosophy department. And I found the chairperson and I says, I want to study philosophy. And he says, have you taken any classes in it? And I go, no. But I just read a bunch of Ravi Zacharias articles and I'm ready. And he goes, well, usually people want to, you know, maybe audit a couple of classes or something like that to see if you like it first. I'm like, nope, I'm all in. I know for sure this is where I need to be. And yeah, man, you know, and I met a lot of wonderful people and took a lot of interesting explorations. And to this day, my personal mantra is philosophy is my psychedelic. Ideas are my intoxication.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I asked you about this. I mean, one, it was just out of curiosity. What was this moment and this book? Because I love these disruptive moments in our lives, or maybe not disruptive. Maybe, you know, it's just sort of like getting us back on the right path or the path that we're supposed to be on. Yeah. But, you know, I was raised with no religion at all. Not really. Like I had the real good fortune of that. My mother was raised by religious fundamentalists, you know, Gideon's, place in the Bibles and, you know, hotel drawers and stuff like that. And my
father's from Syria, you know, an immigrant, and he it was just didn't there wasn't really the kind of Christian meets nomadic people's religion where he, you know, went to in Allentown, outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania. I mean, it was a Syrian Orthodox church, but it's just not the same. And so I was just, you know, my mom would take me to different churches here and there and be like, do you like this? Do you like this? And I mean, I thought it was cool. Like, I always thought about God and religion, but it was the opposite direction for me, where, you know, all that philosophical stuff and the interest in science and everything was there. I wasn't ever an atheist or a non-believer, but I just didn't, that wasn't the way that I would necessarily like take things in. It's certainly not in a religious way. You know, there was a Catholic school near where I grew up, and I had no idea what they were doing. I was like, why do they dress like that? Like, what is up? It's just completely, you know, it was like people playing Dungeons and Dragons or something. I had no idea what they were doing. And then, you know, spirituality became more and more important in my life as I got older, out of my own choice, out of my own decisions, and the way it started entering in, especially through esoteric Christianity and that sort of thing, is just sort of opening and opening and opening. And now it's every day, you know, it's every day it's with me. And so I just think it's, I love these kinds of meetings, you know, to be able to meet you from coming from the completely different direction. Yeah. And then just to sort of find ourselves here as strangers talking as friends around this meeting place where we have a lot in common, though we came from somewhere completely else. And that also seems to be part of the spirit of your work. I mean, you do that a lot, I think, where it's, you know, from my perspective, at least, where you're like, look, you know, there are distinctions here, and distinctions are not to be made into enemies. And there are, you know, maybe there's this political belief or this political belief, but don't let go of your spirit and where you are and your ability to meet people. So just hold on one more second, because I don't do that minimalist 30 second or 60 second, like, I'm not doing it. Sorry. But I was thinking about that moment we're talking about, what's his name? Ravi Zacharias. Is that his name?
Yeah.
And you know, I've never heard of him, but I have this feeling too about people who are, I hate the word problematic. It's such a quantitative term around people's lives. Oh, they're problematic or whatever. It sounds so mathy around the fullness of someone's life. But there are people who have made real contributions to my knowledge and understanding and love of the world that, you know, there's this guy, I talked about him in the last episode, this guy, Massimo Scaligero, who wrote these beautiful books about the nature of reality. Ended up being an Italian fascist. I mean, this is not a scandal even. This is like someone becoming like pretty terrible person. But I think it's, for me, do I judge their works by their life, but can I judge them by the standard of their work? Like, can their work actually be, you know, made to not redeem them, but to show me the fullness of what they could have done and what they could have offered? I think holding them up to the standard of their own work is important, not just the other way around, which is condemning the work based on the thing that they did with their life. And I think having a Christian impulse in your life, you know, it kind of asks us to do some of that as well, to not dismiss or divest responsibility, but to find the, you know, in that story where Christ looks at the teeth of the dead dog and says, look at the beautiful teeth on this dog when they come across it, in that apocryphal story. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is this trouble that we have with owning up to the influences that shape our lives because of their human imperfections. It's kind of an age old struggle between, I'll say, optics and ontology, being versus appearing, how things look versus how they actually are. And you see it in every area of life. You know, for instance, when it comes to becoming smart. What's one of the greatest obstacles to becoming smart? The need to look smart. If you need to look smart, it's incredibly difficult to become smart because the kinds of things you need to do in order to become smart involve looking like someone who doesn't know. Hey, what does that mean? No, I haven't read that. Is that any good? Oh, would you mind explaining that in a different way? That's interesting. What do you mean by that? Oh, you know, I actually don't know why I believe that. I never quite thought about it, but maybe I'll take some time and try to get to the bottom of it and I'll get back to you. You got to do things that make you look like what you are, a person that doesn't know what they're talking about everything. But that's how you become smarter. If you want to become physically fit, you got to be the person that's willing to show up as someone that's not physically fit. You can't say, yeah, man, I can't wait to, you know, get my body together, but I'm not gonna go anywhere and work out yet because people are gonna see me as I am. So I'm gonna wait. And it's like, well, you're standing in your own way, right? And you see, so you think about, let's go back to the Bible. If I haven't lost all your viewers by referencing the Bible,
not at all.
but this is me wrestling with that same dilemma, right? It's if you listen to the content of what I'm saying, even if you are a non-Christian who hates the Bible, you can see that there's this core of truth there that provides value for all people. But what am I wrestling with right now? I don't want to look like a fundamentalist. And so I'm even getting in my own way about naturally referencing something. I wouldn't do this for anything else. If it were a Doctor Strange comic, I would just whip that out and quote it with pride. I would feel good about being the kind of guy who quotes Doctor Strange comics, but I'm not quite at peace with the Bible in that way, right? That's my own resistance. But you have where Jesus is saying, hey, don't be like the religious folk who, whenever they pray really loudly because they want people to hear them. Instead, go pray in a closet where no one can see you. And the God who hears you pray secretly will reward you openly. Well, what's going on there? Well, he's not saying if you ever happen to let anyone overhear you pray, your prayer is going to be canceled out. He's saying, if you're praying for the purpose of other people hearing you and respecting you as a pious person, you're missing the point of prayer. Prayer is kind of like spiritual working out. It's spiritual exercise. You're working out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You're doing the great work of theosis, of deification. You're going within and you're dealing with stuff in the inner worlds. You're raising up your consciousness. And this is really important work. And you don't want to reduce it to something as superficial as playing a game of getting other people to go, oh yeah, that's a real pious guy over there. There's no freedom in that. There's no spiritual liberation in that. And so there's that age-old battle. And how does that play into what we're talking about here? Well, we live in a world where we have to make a choice every day. Do I want to prioritize the pursuit of truth or the appearance of virtue? And those two things don't always go hand in hand. Sometimes you get to look virtuous by being a seeker of truth, but sometimes you don't. And there's a great social reward for conducting yourself in a way that makes you look like you're not affiliated with anything that's messy. There's a reason why the religious folks prayed so loud in order for people to hear them, because it actually worked. There were people who looked up to them and respected them for it, even though they were respecting them for something that was of low value, comparatively speaking. And it's the same today. It's like you see this happen in the celebrity world where the moment someone's reputation goes down, everyone pretends like they didn't know them. Oh, you know, I might have been in the same building with them one time, but I didn't know them. And there are lots of examples of people thanking someone like, oh, thank this guy. He really made my career. He's the guy that really discovered him. I love him so much. As soon as he gets caught up with a scandal, I don't even remember talking to them. And there's such a strong desire to make sure we look a certain way that it can easily get in the way of our pursuit of truth. But it's like, what are you after, man? Are you after getting to the bottom of things? And that's kind of difficult, right? Because if if I refused to receive good ideas from people who were flawed, I would never learn because I would be unable to receive any ideas from my own self. Mm-hmm. You know?
And I think it just, it's also such a, for a lot of people, that dodge of, you know, the accountability of, you know, the many times that we've done wrong, that we've harmed other people. I mean, I'm not an Italian fascist for sure, but who knows where life will lead, but I'm not one now. Yeah. But I've certainly, you know, like I have an ex-boyfriend who would say that like my breakup with him is one of the worst things that's ever happened to him. You know, it's the deep wounding that I've inflicted on other people. Sometimes I'm not going to feel bad for that exactly, but I will look at the fact that I've hurt others, that I've committed, you know, other people to feeling pain. And in ways that I just are shit, you know. In my book, there are two characters who are in this really antagonistic relationship, and you know, these two guys that went to high school together, and there's a shifting of identifying with one and then the other and one and then the other in the reader's mind. So people are like, I'm team Jack or I'm team Todd or whatever when they read the book. A big part of that was that I want to make sure, you know, because they're really doing kind of shitty things to each other. I want to make sure that no one was left unforgiven and no one was left unaccountable, you know, and that way in which forgiveness and accountability and all that sort of weave in and out of each other is really important for the picture as well. I think it goes to something that you said in an interview I listened to with you, where you said, you know, I was very lucky because my parents focused not so much on sin, but on God consciousness when it came to religion, that there was an expansive picture rather than a merely contracted one that came to a point with people's wrongdoings. Obviously, it sounds like there was some stuff going on with a focus on sin sometimes as well, but that the emphasis was on this expansive kind of overview, bigger view of people and, you know, how we learn from that push and pull.
That's right. And that's built into an understanding of sin that is as ancient as the Judeo-Christian faith itself. Certainly, we wouldn't want to commit ourselves to the position that the average person on the street would articulate it this way, right? But it's a very ancient understanding that wasn't invented by my parents at all. And it's a teleological understanding of ethics. The word sin itself, although a loaded term that it'd be hard to get away with using today because it stirs up images of someone sitting in a classroom and a nun at the Catholic school slapping their hands with a ruler for chewing gum in classroom. Those are the kinds of images. But sin just means to miss the mark. And we all have moments where we engage the idea of sin, even though we don't use that religiously charged term, where you evaluate your day and you say, yeah, I probably can do better than that next time. Mm-hmm. Probably can do better than that next time, right? In ancient Christian theology, the opposite of sin is not human decency, but perfection. And if you think about yourself as a being that is in some sense destined or moving towards perfection, then everything that falls short of that is an opportunity for growth, right? And so without an idea of sin or missing the mark, there's no idea of growth. How could I possibly learn something new unless there's some sort of non-dramatic acknowledgement of the fact that I don't know everything? There are a lot of things I don't know. There are a lot of areas where my understanding of the world, it falls short. It's uninformed. I'm ignorant. Now, the solution isn't to sit around feeling guilty about it all day long, but it's to turn that into motivation to engage my curiosities and so on. And so when you think about it theologically, it's like, hey, there are ways of being that in some sense of the word are healthier than others and that lead to more human flourishing than others. And understanding why, understanding cause and effect, understanding incentives, understanding the way our actions affect others and understanding long-term consequences, it's a much better way to go when thinking about our behavior than just imposing a philosophy that says, well, don't you do that. That's bad. Because it kind of signals that the reason that it's bad is because there's some human being who just frowns on us for it. Even the idea of like God just being really angry, you know, the old classic, you know, sinners in the hand of an angry God. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of like, it's more like a parent who looks at their child denying themselves of some fantastic pleasure, some fantastic possibility, because they don't think they're worthy of it. And because they don't think they're worthy of it, they settle for something that's actually self-harming. And that's sort of like what sin is, right? It's like, it's settling for less. It's choosing to be afraid of our own greatness and seeking after things that from a higher perspective that is so passionate about the joy of perfection and the possibilities of life. It's just sad. But we all live that out, and we all have examples of other people that we've seen do this, let alone our own selves. Am I making any sense at all?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I keep thinking of, you know, how, you know, you were talking before about like how trying to look smart gets in the way of being smart, because you have to ask like, hey, I've never heard of that person. Can you tell me more? Like, so on and so forth. How much we have this feeling of I have to demonstrate that I know, or I have to demonstrate that I'm right. I have to show you that I'm right, because if I'm wrong, you know, there's something really terrible about that. If I'm ignorant or I'm unknowing, there's something terrible about that. Like that is a recapitulation of the sense of original sin. Oh, if I'm not right, I must be touching on the fallen part of myself. And by the way, that also means that you better be right when you speak, because if you're not, you know, look, I can't be around someone that's like wallowing in that kind of sin. And I think that that's, you know, the way to get out of that is just to take an interest in who you really are and who the other person is. I mean, take an interest in each other instead of saying it matters. You know, there's a guy, Peter Roth, he's a Christian community priest, but he said something like, you know, it makes no difference to the spiritual world whether or not someone's right or wrong. You know, what matters is if we take an interest in each other. That's of infinite interest to the spiritual world. You use the word curiosity a lot. And I think it's that, can I actually meet the other with interest rather than trying to sort of pick this or that? On this show all the time, people say things I disagree with constantly on my own show, but I almost never go there with them. I'm like, what's the point? Like, I'm here to meet someone. Even if it's someone I've already met, I'm here to meet that person. And disagreement has almost no value to me, really, when it comes down to it, because I work really hard to come up with my own ideas, my own thoughts, so that when I speak, I mean, I'm saying this idealistically, I don't really pull it off all the time, but so that when I speak, what I say is actually true to me. So if someone's going to come in and start disagreeing or pulling apart this or that or debating or whatever, I'm like, we're not going to move anywhere from that. It's not going to be of value to me, because I've worked hard to understand the truth through myself. And, you know, but what could really work is, you know, to move things along and move things forward is an interest in each other and a real sort of resonance with each other, way of attuning ourselves to the other and attuning with that person. And I think, you know, that's how I try to view these things. Now, but I do want to get to this thing though, that you said, that came
can
out.
Can I really quickly comment on what you just said? Yeah. You know, this is a hard one for people. I refer to a phenomenon I call philosophical FOMO, the fear of missing out on a philosophical argument that could possibly lead to something positive. And the expression of philosophical FOMO is a sense of being obliged to involve yourself in any debate that another person wants to have with you. Because if you say no to a debate, well, you're being close-minded, right? You're exposing yourself as a fraud. But this is where it's important to make a distinction between the goodness of debate or dialogue in general and the goodness of debate or dialogue with any given particular person. If I were to walk up to a single person and say, hey, do you think there are good people out there that are worth dating? They'd say, yeah. All right. How about that guy right there? Well, I don't know. Right. I can say with great confidence that there are definitely some good people out there that are worth dating. But if you put one particular individual at random in my face, well, I don't know. There's some information I need to know in order to know if this is worth my time. And it's similar to debate. There's a level of prudence that has to be exercised with individual interactions, all the more so being online now, because we don't have to be facetious when we say these things, but you don't know the mental health of the person on the other side. Half these people are using fake names and fake avatars, have no skin in the game. You don't even know why they're debating. And it doesn't mean you need to have people fill out a questionnaire in order to respond to them. It's not an arrogant position, but it's just that, hey, in a world where we have a limited amount of time and we have goals or we have priorities, it's like, all right, like, the time I spend arguing with a random stranger is also time I could be spending on the phone with my mom, who's always saying that she never gets to talk to me enough. So, you have to be discerning. I think in the same way that intellectual honesty demands that we have good reasons for our beliefs, I believe it also demands that we have good reasons for our behaviors. And since debating is a form of behavior about our beliefs, one ought to have good reasons for engaging in a debate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no debate. I absolutely agree with you. So it's perfect. It really works out. But I think for me, right, the idea of entering in, like someone saying, oh, like you must be closed off or shut down if you won't debate with me, is the same. I mean, how many debates are started because people are shut down already? I saw, I'm going to forget the other guy's name, but it was Deepak Chopra and someone else debate once about, does God exist? And they were, and then the audience got to vote who won. And it was clear that everybody just voted based on who they already believed in or who they were there to see. I mean, you were either there to see Deepak Chopra or the other guy, you know, and it was just like, yeah, that's who you vote for. I mean, the idea that was going to sway someone because they were meeting, the intellect's so important and it's so agile, and I love the intellect, but without your heart, I mean, without a sense of warmth, it's really just a cold surface. I mean, it's a reflection, in the same way that your reflection has no depth, it's an image of depth, but it's not depth itself. It has to be joined by the heart and meeting someone. And so therefore I can't really take on a debate without that kind of warmth. And when you bring that warmth, it's usually not a debate anyway. It goes somewhere else entirely.
And by the way, I do love debates. I love watching them. I love learning from them. I think they have a great role, and I've learned a ton from debates. And there are some people that do them at a really high productive level. And I think debates are worth fighting for. We just have to make a distinction between constructive debates that we watch and debates that we feel obligated to insert ourselves into personally. One of my favorite memes is, you're not obligated to attend every argument that you're invited to. But I know you had another question that you wanted to ask.
Well, so no, I mean, it was just about the way that you were wrestling with this, like, oh, now people are going to hear me say this about the Bible. Like, I do this. Yeah. I do this on the show a lot where I laugh at myself because I know I'm going off the deep end on some topic, like really just going into it.
Yeah.
And I know that there's a third party present, which is the listener.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, okay, so you guys are like, Connor, what the fuck are you talking about? And then I'll like try to reel it back in and go through the steps that I skipped over for the people that are listening. But I also like can hear in you that that's something that's not that. I mean, you said as much. Like, what's happening there? Because, you know, you appear to me, at least, I don't want to make assumptions, but you have this real anchor, you know, you have this real strength of presence, like you're with yourself, you know, and yet there's this thing, which is interesting to me. Oh, yeah. Who are you imagining? Now are they a spot? I mean, listen, I will say, you know, you're Catholic and I live in Ireland where the Catholic Church has probably done more to damage people than most places in the world. I mean, they killed. I mean, there's just like this whole thing that the country is going through right now, finding these hundreds of babies like buried in a septic tank that the Catholic Church like buried them. I mean, it's just horrific. And so every conversation I have about religion here or spirituality here, I have to do some ameliorating work with anger before I even get in, you know, to the meat of the conversation. But I don't think you're thinking about my Irish listeners. Something else is going on. So what's happening there?
So a starting point is, when you think about Christianity in the first couple of centuries, or just think about the entire pre-Constantine period, it had the disadvantage of you being persecuted if you were a believer. But it had the rhetorical advantage of being a radical countercultural philosophy. If you're walking around in the first century and you mention Yeshua to someone, there's a decent chance they may not have even heard the name. Or they may have heard the name and say, yeah, I've kind of heard about a miracle worker or a great teacher or something. What do you know? What have you seen? What have you heard? And the way in which people engage that was with curiosity or open-mindedness. And of course, sometimes great hostility as well. But there's something about people not thinking that they know what you're talking about that makes them more inclined to hear you out. You take Christianity post-Constantine, where it becomes legalized, it becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire, Christianity goes mainstream, it becomes commercialized, popularized. We're now at a place in history where, especially in America, if you go to anyone and ask them, have they ever heard of Christianity or the Bible or Jesus, chances are the average person has already been wounded, ticked off, or deeply hurt by someone in the name of Christ. Mm-hmm. Right? Chances are just about everybody knows at least a handful of really annoying, unlikable Christians who have ticked them off about something. And so when you bring up something like the Bible, something like Jesus, there is a presupposed familiarity with these things, particularly in the West, that doesn't quite carry over to other religions or other religious teachers. So when I quote Sufi mystics here in the States, I never get any resistance. Any Eastern philosophers I quote, I never get any resistance. In fact, I can quote Eastern Orthodox saints if I remove the saint from the name, right? And because they don't recognize it. They don't know who Athanasius is, right? I can say the Desert Fathers and they, oh, that sounds quite esoteric and mystical and doesn't seem like it's been contaminated by the Christian fundamentalist Republicans, right? There's kind of like this image, the Bible thumper, so to speak. And so I found in my experience, I love to engage a variety of different thinkers, and I never encounter resistance when I quote religious or spiritual philosophers, except when I quote Jesus or the Bible. And I don't think that's because it's a conspiracy. I don't think people are like demon possessed and they're objecting to that for that reason. It's just that familiarity, as the saying goes, it breeds contempt, right? In fact, one of the ways you see this playing out in the university setting or even in people's spiritual quest, whenever people are itching for the mystical or itching for the esoteric, they tend to go east. And it's typically presupposed that Christianity, whatever it is, it's definitely not east. You go to any, you know, academic institution and you study religions, Christianity is not going to be in the Eastern religions, even though in every sense of the word, it's an Eastern religion, right? Because it's got this image. And so part of what's going on there is this audience that's in my imagination, and this doesn't make me right. This is just me explaining what's going on. There's an audience of people there. I want them to hear the story. I want them to see some kernel of truth that might be useful to them. And I don't want them to miss it or assume they already know where I'm going or dismiss it because, you know, Uncle Jimmy pissed them off with the Bible 10 years ago. Right. And it's partially my way of saying, look, I'm not your Uncle Jimmy. I don't know him. I don't take responsibility for any arrogance he might have had when he talked with you about the Bible. I'm not here to beat you over the head with the Bible. I'm just telling a story. And this one happens to be told by Jesus. You know, I remember my first episode of The Minimalist, by the way, when I joined the team, I wasn't even thinking about it. But I pissed off some people because we were talking about integrity being based on what you do rather than what you say. And I told the parable of how Jesus talks about these two sons, and the father, you know, says, hey, can you do this task for me? And the first son says, I will do it. And the second son is like, no, I'm not going to do it. The first son who said he's going to do it, he goes away and he forgets. The second son who said he wasn't going to do it, he decides, you know, I'll help the old man out, basically. And he goes and does it. The moral of the story is that the man of virtue is not the one who says the right thing. The man of virtue is the one who does the right thing. And it's a pretty basic story. You don't have to think that it's the most profound thing. It's just the one that came up at that time. And there were so many people that were like, oh, as soon as this guy started quoting the Bible, I knew I knew I had to be done. And so I think there's some personal defensiveness and insecurity I'm working through when it comes to that, where it's like, I don't want to be lumped into these categories. And then there's also a genuine sense of like, I'm just so passionate about stories that there's a part of me that always, whether I'm telling the story or not, feel a sense of loss when someone walks away from a story that they might otherwise like, because they heard the name of someone that, that they associate with evil or something along those lines. That's kind of like my on the spot, on the fly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's current, right? Like you're still going through it. So you don't have a complete answer yet, because if you did, you wouldn't be exhibiting or going through.
There you go.
But I mean, yeah, I mean, I definitely hear all that. There's so many things that came up for me. Like, I think in general, like, the people whose politics I mostly find myself aligned with, which is leftist politics, are just pretty much been hostile to religion and spirituality, like from get-go. And I have had to sort of wade through that. Although I find a lot of times when I have people who are on the show that are socialists or Marxists, or the anarchists are a little easier with it, but they also desperately want to talk about spiritual matters. because it's not located in the political economy that they're working with at all. And so they find themselves in these conversations because it's nourishing. So there is then the care, you know, of the wound that needs to be tended to, but also if there's not necessarily a wound, I mean, maybe they just grew up with atheist parents or, you know, anti-theist parents or whatever it is, it's still like, okay, well, let's see if we can find our way to meaning, you know, together. And so I will often say, if I'm talking about Christ, I'll often be like, I'll find the alternate version of the story to give at the same time. Like I'll say the story. Mm-hmm. I won't quote the Bible usually, but I'll say something. And then I'll say like, but if you want to just think about it this way without the religious stuff, you can think about it this way.
Yeah.
And sometimes though, I find myself thinking, I don't want to give that escape. I don't give that escape hatch anymore because is that on the one hand, I feel like I'm communicating and that's really necessary to meet someone where they are. On the other hand, I feel like I'm actually betraying the truth. So that's been a difficult struggle for me. I only did one episode ever where I talked about the Archangel Michael. It was a solo episode. And I said, listen, on every other episode, I give you like the escape hatch. But this one, because of what I'm talking about, I'm not going to give it to you. I just want you to sit with this as if it's real for this half hour. And like, if you can't do that, that's okay. But I request that you do that to listen to this one. And I think, you know, I don't know if I'm working towards being someone that doesn't give that little extra door anymore, or if it's necessary. If actually what I hope is to be someone who radiates what's within me enough that someone doesn't have to worry about the worry their wound when they're around me, that actually it's like, okay, I can sit with this anyway. There's a sort of to go east darshan aspect of just sitting with this way of speaking.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's the thing with the image of Jesus as well, where, you know, look, I'm Syrian. So I have the benefit of being like part of, I mean, I'm half Irish as well, but I have the benefit of being basically the ethnicity that Jesus was. So maybe I'm like talking out of turn here, but when people try to make Jesus their own race, you know, or national, like whether it's a blonde Jesus, a black Jesus, an Indian Jesus, whatever, I think I understand why people do that. But on the other hand, you need to be able to see this figure also as someone that is separate from you, that you can't identify with, that feels far away from you. And you actually have to do the work of bridging the gap yourself to feel that alignment, because that actually is the act and engagement and in evincing of Christ is the difference, is the gap between you, is the chasm, you know, between you and this being who's suffering. And so, or walking around, doesn't have to be on the cross. But so when I talk about creating that sort of escape hatch for people to just only identify with their own beliefs rather than moving towards the intensity of the cosmic thing that I'm saying.
Yeah.
So ridiculous, but it's true. Then sometimes I feel like I'm doing a disservice to the actual work of Christianity to begin with.
Yeah. And that can come from a space that's deeper than feeling obligated to represent the faith in a certain kind of way. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is when you think about how people have come to acquire these negative associations, it's rarely by directly engaging primary resources, right? It's often by engaging people in the communities who claim to practice this faith, who might live in a certain way or who might have said something hurtful or whatever it may be. And so people acquire negative associations through negative experiences with believers or with thinkers. And well, how will those negative associations be healed? Or how will new associations be created? By people interacting with people that are different, who also have those associations. And there's kind of a fine line between knowing your audience and making those adjustments in your message so that they can just get the point, right? So I'm going to tell this story about a guy who said to a guy who said to another guy, but I'm not going to let you know it came from Exodus. Because if you know that it came from the book of Exodus, you're going to tune me out. There's a fine line between doing that, which sometimes the context seems to demand, and giving people an opportunity to evolve in response to a new quality of energy. Because, hey, I came to love the Bible because I heard people make it sound cool. I heard people who were different from some of the other people who initially shaped my understanding of scripture. I heard from people who made it sound fun. I heard it from people that weren't trying to police my life, but they were just telling a cool story. And we can be that for other people. And it's bigger than just the Bible. It's for everything. It's for all these labels that we use to limit people. We hear people's position on something and we say, oh, you're a conservative, or oh, you're a liberal, or someone identifies as a liberal and we say, oh, well, you must believe this. And the way that we introduce nuance into the world is by sometimes just being an example of someone who is associated with a certain label, but whose relationship to it is multifaceted, more so than what people have previously encountered. So, yeah, there's some good stuff there. Hey, one other, I'll say this very quickly. Maybe as I'm processing in real time, a more vulnerable answer too, perhaps a less noble sounding answer to why I wrestle with this, is because I'm still in the process of owning how I want to show up in the world. You know, how much of ourselves we give to the public, there tends to be a gap between that and all the things we say, think, and feel in private. And being in this podcasting space, this writing space, the education entrepreneurial space, I work in a way, I make my living in a way to where I'm putting my thoughts out there. And there's a kind of process where when I evolve philosophically or psychologically, and I'm integrating those ideas and so on, there's a process of maybe deciding how much of this aspect of me do I want to give to the world? Am I ready for that yet? Am I ready to talk about my theory on aliens? You know, you know what I mean? Like there are conversations.
Well, we'll definitely do that after the call. Yeah,
for sure. you get what I'm saying, right? We all have absolutely these conversations we're willing to have in private, but then it's sort of like, okay, am I ready to engage the broader world on this? And I think I'm still in the process of owning who I really am and what I believe in public, and even grappling with my own ideas about persecution and the fear thereof. Because for every belief that you have, for every perspective that you adopt, there are social rewards and consequences. There are spaces I can go to because I'm Catholic and I can get some love that non-Catholics won't get. But there are also spaces I can go to because I'm Catholic and I can catch some heat and some hate that other people won't catch. And just dealing with that, you know, I'm in some ways I'm newer at that because I'm owning these ideas in a way that I haven't for a very long time.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, there's this component there of also how much of the broader world do I need to be in? I mean, and that's the real, like that. And just for everybody that's listening and loves this show, I'm not directing this at you guys at all, because I feel genuine love that we are connected with you listening and being here with me and this time TK and everybody else that comes on the show, but I want to make myself less accessible, not because I can't stand the fame or anything like that. It's not like that, but because I need more room and more space in me to, again, let what needs to show up. And I spend so much time organizing all the outward pieces and events and, you know, putting myself out there that I actually have been in that for so long. I mean, you're in LA and that's the current of that city. I lived in LA for 5 years. It's like, I love LA. I mean, it's my favorite US city, but it will pull you in that current of, I need to have everybody involved. Even if your heart is pure, it's very difficult to resist the current of a place. If you lived in New York, you'd feel one way. If you lived in San Francisco, because everybody's talking about it, the way the city is organized around networking, being seen, talking to the right people, all that kind of stuff. It's a very public life. The sky is big because the buildings aren't tall and the sun is always on. I mean, you're on stage in LA. And I think that I'm trying to actually move away a bit, as Twitter seems to be sort of just falling apart at the seams. I'm just like, thank God I've been on this thing for 10 years. Like, thank God. As a lot of other things seem to start sort of falling away, I'm like, okay, I'm starting to be able to breathe a little bit more, feel a little bit more, you know, into myself and my own being. So
yeah.
I think that's another part of what you're talking about. And that's a very scary part when, for me at least, I'm thinking, well, maybe I can't speak all the time in the way I want to because my imagined crowd is so huge that it's always got to be the world. But actually maybe the world is the spiritual world that I'm engaging with. That's who I'm speaking to. And I'm speaking to the all of us that are united in spirit, not the all of us right here driving our cars and living our lives and listening to podcasts and, you know, whatever all the time.
Man, that's a lot of good stuff in there, man. First, you make me think about the author Walter Wink, who wrote a book called The Powers That Be, and went on to write what came to be known as the Powers Trilogy, Unmasking the Powers, Naming the Powers, and Engaging the Powers, I believe. But he has this idea that angels and demons are not merely these sort of like Hollywood-styled or cartoonish sort of beings with the white outfits and the wings, but they are kind of like the personality, the governing personalities or the defining personalities of institutions, of cities, of territories, of principalities, if you will. And so when you go into a city like LA, for instance, or you go into a city like Dallas, or you go into a city like Chicago, they have these distinct personalities that are so energetically strong that it's almost like, if you live there long enough, you kind of get swept up into them. And even though you might retain some core essence of who you are, it's almost like the LA version of you, the Nashville version of you, right? The Chicago version of you. I experienced this when I lived in Charleston. There's definitely a sense in which I not only hated it when I first got there, but by the time I left 4 years ago, it's like the South had gotten into me in some kind of way. It was so quiet that it was frightening. It was scary. I go for a walk and I'd be like, I'm going to get murdered and nobody's even going to know I'm missing for like 6 months. It's so quiet, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas in LA, the probability of getting murdered is much higher, but somebody will know right away because right. They'll watch it.
It'll be on TV at least.
right. At least somebody will know. But, you know, but by the time I left there, it's like that quiet, I internalize that in a certain way, and it's almost a part of who I am. And so He has some very interesting ideas, and I think there's something to this idea that it's more than just the individual people that are there. There's something going on that is arguably greater than the sum of its parts. A little esoteric spiritual warfare, if you will. And he goes on to talk about like demons are really kind of like institutions, organizations, cities, territories that have kind of lost their way in a sense, and that are in need of redemption. But anyway, the other thing is this idea about the audience of everyone. It just makes me think of how we're in the age of what I'll call opinion porn, where we're experiencing some realities that I'm not quite sure we are hardwired to handle. If you think about the concept of fame for most of human history, it was local. Mm-hmm. You only knew about the opinions of people that you worked with, that you lived with, that you lived by, and maybe people if you had some sort of religious or spiritual community. And even then, you had to understand that you don't focus on everybody's opinions within those communities. But it was very local. The idea of you being a non-emperor, and knowing what someone 100 miles away is even doing, or let alone what they think of your opinions, that's unheard of for most of history. And now we have all those same things. We got neighbors, we got family, classmates, coworkers, but we also have this ability to engage the opinions of people that we'll never meet, that we'll never know, people that are hundreds of miles away, thousands of miles away, and we know what they think about the same movie that we saw. And we can argue about LeBron James and Michael Jordan. I'm so glad growing up in Chicago, I didn't have arguments about LeBron James and Michael Jordan growing up. I was just able to enjoy. I was just able to enjoy it, right? I wasn't having arguments with millions of people about it. But it's like, that's a lot for us to carry. And the jury's still out on how much of it we can carry. But what's definitely necessary, well, actually, I don't know if the jury's still out. I just haven't delved into it deep enough to know. But what's definitely true is, in this day and age, you need a philosophy of attention. You need to have a philosophy for what you're not going to pay attention to, what you are going to tune out, because we are absolutely exposed to far more than we can possibly keep up with.
Well, you know, you said I went to Charleston, it was quiet, and now that quietude is a part of me now that I moved here. I think a lot of this, well, so I'm just going to go for it. I think now, like, I did an episode on how our concept of time and space is changing. Long time ago, I did this episode, like 4 years ago or something. But part of where I located that is, you know, when we landed on the moon, humanity lands on the moon, and I forget which astronaut it was, but he like put up his thumb. I was looking at the Earth and put up his thumb, and he said to the other guy, "Everything I've ever known is behind my thumb." Because he was putting it in front of the Earth, right? No one had conceptualized of the Earth in this way before, from a distance, from seeing the whole, from imbibing and taking the whole in. And now time has marched on, and we have these devices which we access the entirety of the world just by using our thumb, tapping on this, tapping on that, bringing it all up, changing our concept of space again with our thumbs. We carry the entirety of the planet in ourselves now. I mean, that from that view, that was the physical sign of it. It was probably happening. Wow. It was all in the works up until then as well, because we had the idea to go to the moon in the first place and see the Earth and all that kind of stuff. And we were creating globes and all that. But when we got that image and we brought it back down, it was like the grand moving from Charleston to this new place. Humanity contained that image. We are learning how to deal with it. That is a movement in our spiritual evolution, is that we've not just evolved, but involved the entirety of the planet in our consciousness. How could we not be profoundly changed forever by that. And so I think it's about fame, it's about connectivity, but it's also about space itself has changed. Time itself has changed. And that's going to have profound effects. We'll certainly have profound effects on money, on labor, on the way we interact with each other, on our sense of the other. You know, when we were in lockdowns, we were in small spaces at the same time, confined physically in space, imagining the entirety of the world going through something. And we were able to do that. I mean, that interconnectivity, I'm going to sit in my room and feel the presence of the world. I mean, again, it's this change, this spiritual like movement in our consciousness as we go forward. And so it's a lot to handle. I mean, I'm doing all right with it, but it's a lot to handle.
Yeah. And since adaptation is a response to the change that happens in an environment, you're always playing catch up, right? So we're in the position of adapter, so we're in the effect position, so to speak, and we've got to upgrade our own consciousness, our own tools of navigation, our own conceptual schemas. We've got to upgrade those in response to the changes, but the changes have already happened, and we're playing catch up with that. But that's what makes it fun.
Or maybe it's the other way around too, which would also be is the way I think about it is that all the physical stuff is the symptom of the inner world. You know, we tend to talk about technology as driving the changes in consciousness, but that came out of us. That came from our dreams and our desires and our ideas and our fantasies and our work and our connections built these things. And then we're like, oh, that changed us. But the consciousness level, that inner level, that spirit level is where the real site of action is. And I think that that's, you know, again, when I look at your work and it's like, I'm not talking to you about taking political sides. You can do that. That's fine. But I'm talking to you about who and what you are and what that offers. I'm not talking to you about on the ground action. That's important. You do that. You take on the ground action and you become an entrepreneur or you become a minimalist or whatever it is you want to become. But I'm talking to you about who you are. And then, you know, we can know that actually we're the site of action. We're the site of direction. We're the site of, you know, where everything's going on.
That's right. The revolution of the heart. And I've often said that I'm not merely interested in creating a world in which everyone feels free. Yes, but the way we get there is by creating individuals or cultivating individuals who can learn how to live freely in any kind of society. And that requires an understanding of an interior kind of freedom. And I agree with you about the changes being a reflection of the inner world. And what it makes me think about is that there's a synthesis here. It's kind of both. There are a lot of movies. You see this as a common trope in sci-fi. You see it in Event Horizon, the science fiction film. You see it in the horror movie film Apparition. Even an episode of Stargate Atlantis where there's this community and there's just this entity that everyone's trying to deal with, and no one can like destroy this entity, and it wreaks so much havoc and fear. But they discover that the entity is a manifestation of the consciousness of the people. And so they've got to do the inner work to kind of sort out all the things they've got going on. And they don't defeat the monster, but they dissolve the monster by going within and winning the battle for their own souls. And there's two sides to this. It's on one end, it's we who are creating it. You know, this is a reflection of us. But just because we created it doesn't mean that it's easy to deal with, because whenever we externalize something, it kind of has a life of its own that resists the efforts to pull it back in. You know what I mean? And so it becomes this sort of thing where it's like a character in a novel you write. It came from you. Mm-hmm. But there comes a point where if you go far enough, like in the earliest stages, when you first think of that character, it's very fragile and you could just kill it like that if you want. But there's a point where if you keep giving in to what's coming out of you, you keep giving into it, that character is going to have a life of its own, and you can't pull it back.
For anybody that would question that, just think about the moment you formed a bad picture of someone and the moment you meet them again and they've done nothing wrong that time, but you have pulled apart every little thing they've done. It's so hard to reclaim that. And, you know, one of my spiritual teachers, not that I've met him in the flesh because he's dead, but Dasklos, he says, calls it all, it's all elementals. Like, these are beings. We are creating and adding to beings. And he said something curious. He's like, once you have the thought, you've got 7 seconds to get rid of it. And if you don't get rid of it by then, it's out in the world. And all you can do is reinforce it. You know, it's loose.
Wow.
And everything's made out of that. Our bodies are made out of elemental beings. The material world is made out of these beings. And in some ways, reality itself is just the density of these beings that we've agreed upon that have settled into a kind of heaviness. And so, you know, when you think about reality that way, you start thinking about what your errant thoughts can do, your words, the way you look at people, the things you create, all of that. And it's hard to dissolve those things. And the way you can dissolve them is, you know, I had this guy, Ari Torsen, on the show, who is a cult veterinarian acupuncturist. And we talked about his healing practice and we talked about demons and we talked about Christ. And he was just like, I just find the Christ point, this point of nothingness when I want to heal. And I touch on that and it dissolves the disease. It dissolves the pathology and it doesn't displace it or translocate it. It actually dissolves it. So you have to sort of go to this place of the heart to be able to contend with these things that we've set loose and are setting loose, even now as we speak, T.K. Coleman.
So another Bible verse that makes me think of what your friend said to you and the observations you're making about the externalization of inner angst in many of our monsters taking that form. There's a very strange verse that doesn't really seem to make much sense in light of this idea of like divine omnipresence. And the verse is, seek the Lord while he yet may be found. And it's like, well, what the heck does that mean? You know, like how can there be times and spaces where God is not found, right? But one aspect of that is deal with your impulses, your ideas, and your intuitions while they are still in a space interiorly where you can find them and do something about them. Because if you let those things get out into the world, as you just described, and they take form, they externalize, they begin to have a life on their own, and they become far more elusive in your efforts to deal with them, right? And so one aspect of seeking God while he yet may be found is responding to that grace that allows us to go within and do the inner work on the things we need to get under control while we have optimal agency for dealing with them. But when we hesitate, when we procrastinate, when we put off that inner work, it gets out of control and there's always a possibility for redemption, but it's a little bit harder to see the evidence for grace when you're dealing with an externalized monster. Mm-hmm. The monster's easier to see when it's externalized, but the grace to deal with it becomes more difficult to see.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. It once it appears to you, yeah. What is John Whiteside Parsons, who is a rocket scientist, who is the student of Aleister Crowley, but he said, you know, the time for fight for freedom is before it's taken away. Well, once it's taken away, it's too late. You know, you can't, it's so difficult to fight for it once it's gone. I think it's, you know, I mean, and he was talking about the inner world. He wasn't talking about resisting necessarily some external force. Just to be clear for people listening. I mean, I think that's when you see the monster, it's also, you know, just to add maybe one more level to that, it's easier to fight the monster when you can see it. And I think that's part of the problem people have is that most people, I'm saying most people, but lots of people, including myself in different aspects of my life, can't always identify when a monster is being created, right? It's like, it's better to actually see it in front of me so I can try to do something and dissolve it than it is not even knowing that I'm generating it, that I'm creating it. And that's the other kind of bind there is, how do I know when my actions are contributing to this thing? How do I refine myself, refine my character, and also, you know, develop a real capacity and aptitude for distinguishing between the actions that are free and the actions that are compulsive? You know, when I used to do this thing, maybe you've had a time like this in your life too, where I wouldn't open my mail because I was afraid of the bills. And of course, what happens when you do that is that you get more mail with more bills, and it costs more and more and more and more. But I wasn't able to even really, if I look at those times, I felt at least that I wasn't even able to see, open this. It was like there came a certain point where I just started putting them to the side and just not looking at all. So there wasn't even really the freedom to distinguish that this was actually making the monster pile up, you know, until I had this monster shaped stack of paper on the desk. So, I mean, I think it's also that trick too. And that requires not always direct action, but just real development of the self through contemplation, meditation, prayer, all that sort of thing.
Yeah. It's, the cultivation of mindfulness, right? Life is always speaking, but we are not always working on our ability to hear. Mm-hmm. And the notion of anything spiritual being an acquired taste is kind of an affront to our consumeristic culture. But there are clearly things in life that simply can't be tasted or heard or discerned without engaging in some sort of discipline that's designed to help you notice things that you instinctively don't notice, or perhaps instinctively do notice, but have lost touch with.
Right.
So you think of a, you know, maybe the first time you listen to jazz, it might sound like three guys playing three different instruments at the same time. But then you take a jazz appreciation class. You don't take it to force yourself to like something that you don't like. You take it to open your heart and open your mind to something new. And you learn about the structure of it. You learn about the relationship between structure and spontaneity, the role that improv plays. And you learn that when these guys are scatting, that they're actually emulating the saxophone, and they're using the voice as an instrument, and you start to make all of these connections. And after a while, jazz begins to open up to you, and you experience this genuine ability to listen to John Coltrane without getting a headache. But it's not as easy as putting on the radio and just going with whatever the DJ is playing, because even if it ain't my genre, there's one thing I can know about what's going to be on the radio. It's going to be catchy, and I'm going to sing it later on, because how many of us know what it's like to be singing a song and you're like, I don't even like Justin Bieber, dude. Why am I doing this? but it's catchy, right? Uh-huh. And to say that something is catchy means that it's easy to grasp, right? It's easy to grasp. It's right there. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to psychological and spiritual insight, there are some things that we have to work at noticing. And it's good to know that that's not a bad thing. That's an okay thing. That's part of the journey. And so we can cultivate the kind of mindfulness that allows us to recognize as we're taking those steps, hey, I'm in the process of creating a monster. When we externalize the monster, it's not that that's the first time it can be noticed, but rather that's the first time you can notice it if you have been working very hard at not paying attention. It's kind of like if I'm across the room and I say, Connor, 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 and I'm calling you, I'm calling you, man. But if you're distracted and you're not listening, you got your headphones on, you're not hearing me. And so there's come a point where I got to get in front of your face and go, hey, Hunter. And then you say, yeah, that's not the first time I'm talking.
Why that's are you shouting? That's what I say. You know?
right. Why are you yelling at me? Right. And then we get into a fight over me yelling. And
yeah.
But that's what we do to life, right? Like, why are you yelling at me? Why is the universe picking on me?
Because you weren't listening. Yeah.
Yeah. C.S. Lewis says that pain is God's megaphone for arousing a spiritually deaf world. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like, you don't get fat by eating fast food the first time, right? Like, in other words, like, man, can you imagine how different we'd all behave if like consequences were instantaneous? Like, imagine like I go to McDonald's, you know what I mean? You know, I just get whatever I like to get and like in real time, but my belly's going to be exactly the same. Now I got a belly that I can slim down, but like, it's going to be exactly the same while I'm eating. Mm-hmm. It's every day. And then over time, it's like, whoa, what happened? What happened? Well, it's what was happening. It's what's been happening for the past several months. But now it's more noticeable and we respond to those dramatic things. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can cultivate the kind of awareness that says, you know what? I can feel a difference in how that sits in my body, you know? There's some times where like I've eaten some really delicious sweets, and while I was eating them, it felt so good. But then as soon as I was done, it's almost like there was like somebody just like dropped a lump of coal in my stomach, right? And I just felt lifeless. And it's like, whoa, I'm becoming a little bit more aware, right? And you can do that. You can notice it early on. You don't have to wait 6-7 months to see what five slices of cheesecake is doing.
Yeah. I mean, there's on the one hand, the fear of letting go of McDonald's and there's also the fear of developing that sense too. Right. So, cause what I'm thinking of is when you say that is, you know, before we learn to read, I mean, this always blows my mind when I think about it, the symbols are incomprehensible. I mean, you're surrounded by all kinds of squiggles and, you know, whatever. And you're just like, all right. And then suddenly it really is, it feels almost sudden. Like you learn to read and the symbols make sense. And you're suddenly surrounded by a world of new meanings, designating all sorts of things around you. And you can't unlearn it. You can't, I mean, it's probably possible or you can get an injury, but otherwise you can't unlearn it. And so suddenly the world is populated by all kinds of new meaning that was always there. But yeah, like the music of the spheres, it's always playing, but you can't necessarily tune into that and you can't hear that. And so there's the fear of that too. It's the fear of losing McDonald's, but also the fear of gaining the capacity that populates the world with all kinds of meanings that, like the image of the earth or, you know, these other things that we might be afraid to acquire on a certain level. I don't know if I feel that fear anymore, to be honest. I don't know if I feel that fear, but I do feel an intensity that I'm not up to it. So it's not that I fear the content of the thing coming in anymore, but sometimes I'm like, there's a humility question there. Like, and it's good to have humility of, am I able to handle what's coming to me now? Because it's more and more and more and more, yeah. But I just continue to say yes to it, you know?
Yeah. Okay. The fear of letting go of McDonald's. That could be the title of this podcast. But,
I'm loving it.
here's an insight from Catholic theology that I think brings so much value to bear on things like the fear of letting go of McDonald's. So even if you're not Catholic, stay tuned. I did it.
did it.
Dang it.
Sorry.
I'm a work in progress. I'm a work in progress. Oh, I'm a bad Catholic. I didn't say I was a saint. Okay. There's a distinction between what some theologians call moral uprightness and moral perfection. The best way I can describe it is moral uprightness is when you make an effort to bring your behavior into conformity with that which you recognize to be good. It might take striving. It might take discipline. It might take sacrifice. It's not going to be easy to do, but you don't do it because it feels good or it's convenient, but you do it because it's the right thing, right? And for all of us, the journey begins with moral uprightness, because anytime you initiate a process of change, there is a kind of striving because everything's new. But the goal is moral perfection. And what is moral perfection? Moral perfection is when you do something good as an organic response to reoriented desire. So when you attempt to do what is good through that initial struggling and striving, what happens is you begin to reorient your appetites and you acquire a taste for the things that are better, the things that are higher. And you gradually begin to reject some things from the past, things that it took discipline to resist. You reject them out of a kind of aesthetic snobbishness, if you will, that says, oh man, I can't drink that mud water. I need a real cup of coffee. Like we all have our own personal examples of this with taste, right? It's like Josh and Ryan have spoiled me with coffee, where it's like, man, I'll take it anywhere, man. I'll take it from a gas station. I'll take it from McDonald's, Starbucks, Chick-fil-A. Brother, if they sell coffee, I'm drinking it. And I'm still mostly that guy. I used to be 100% that guy. I'm still mostly that guy. But when we're on set and we're in the show, we always get this high quality coffee. And the only reason I'm drinking it is because I'm stuck on set and I can't go get the Starbucks, right? And they're putting that in front of me. And so that's what I'm drinking. And
I need to know where that's from, by the way. Sorry, because I'm from LA. So I need to know where that's coming from.
I'll get you the information. I gotta get it from Alabama. But over time, I'm drinking this coffee and I'm developing this sensitivity. Like, oh man, I'm like tasting some blueberry notes. Like, what's happening to me? You know, like something's happening. Mm-hmm. I'm not accustomed to tasting coffee like this. And recently I was on the road and I was in a hotel and I tried to drink some coffee and I almost spat it out. It was so bad. And I thought, oh, this is just a bad batch, but I tried it later. And I've noticed this, you know, in other spaces where, my appetite is starting to change as the result of what I'm exposing myself to. Right. Or take, for instance, people that have eaten like a Kobe beef burger, or take people that have like, you know what a $40 burger tastes like. Right. If you eat that enough, and then you try to go have McDonald's, you're not going to reject it out of discipline. You're going to reject it because like there's a quality of beef that you're accustomed to and that will taste gross to you. And so the fear of letting go of McDonald's, which is a metaphor of like breaking away from our addictions and worldly attachments or the things that are holding us back. In the beginning, it's kind of like moral uprightness. There's a struggling, there's a striving, but in that struggling and striving, we move closer and closer to something that is resembling the perfection of those who do what is healthy out of an acquired taste for what is good. And when you talk to people that have been living healthy lives for a long time, they say these crazy sounding things like, I enjoy going for a run, or like, no, man, I actually have a good meal. This is really delicious. And they look at that kid, you know, eating a bag of Skittles, and they think to themselves, no, it takes zero discipline to say no to the Skittles, man. It sounds gross to me. It sounds like it's something that is like so dead. It sounds like I'm putting metal into my body. It makes me want to throw up just thinking about it. Like, there is that level of consciousness, right? And we have examples in our own lives of different things. You just got to find the right one. And that's the goal. How can I expose myself to the kinds of experiences, the aesthetic experiences and the ascetic experiences that reorient my appetites in such a way that I begin to more naturally desire what is good for me, what is healthy for me, by acquiring a taste for it, even if the initial process involves some struggle and striving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And I love, you know, the spiritual purification of rejecting Skittles is pretty good.
I'm speaking from my heart here, man. None of this is theoretical.
I don't want to taste that rainbow anymore. there's so many things I want to talk with you about that we'll talk again and approach them. You know, the spiritual qualities of economy and the appropriate ways to approach the political realm, and ethical individualism is the term I have for, you know, well, that Rudolf Steiner has, but that I have for, you know, what you were talking about before with the individual and purification and all this. There's so much. And I love leaving a conversation with that feeling of just wanting to spend more time talking with you. So thank you so much for this conversation and everything you do, TK Coleman.
Oh man, Connor, this is awesome, man. Thank you, brother.
Thank you. And thanks everybody for listening. Bye now.